Bat Force Radio.
Bat Force Radio is rated M for mature. Or should that be immature?
Hey guys, Dustin Nguyen.
Hey, this is Scott Snyder.
This is Paul Dini.
And you're listening to Bat Force Radio.
And you're listening to Bat Force Radio.
You're listening to Bat Force Radio.
This is Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman. And you're listening to Bat Force Radio, so stay tuned.
Welcome back to Bat Force Radio. Hey, look, there's Grandpa Batman.
Hey!
And we've got Teasus over there.
Believe.
And Bat Force Tom.
Gianni Thunder's a bitch.
Oh, I'm telling him you said that. And I'm Robin Cross. And we've got a two-for-one deal on offer this week. We've got two creators joining us to talk about something that we've all gotten pretty excited about lately. So one is joining us for the first time, known for work on books like Flash, American Vampire, Weapon X, and Hit Girl. The other has been here several times and has yet to learn his lesson. He is known for work like the Batman White Knight Universe books, Red Hood and Generation Joker, as well as Bloody Hell that we have talked about at length on here before. Together, on April 16th, they will release the first issue of their new Comixology original series, Hardstyle Juice. Welcome to talk about it with us, Mr. Ricardo Lopez-Ortiz and Mr. Clay McCormick.
Hey, what's up, guys? And I haven't learned my lesson because you put a microphone in front of me and let me talk, I'm not going to say no.
Yeah, and well, every time, you know, like we're in your DMs sending nudes and stuff, so how can you help yourself?
We are?
Yeah,
that was you.
I forwarded yours. But how the hell you guys been?
Good. Yeah, we're pretty psyched that the book is finally coming out. It's been a bit of a long road, long gestational period, but it's coming out and feeling good about it.
Yeah, same.
So yeah. how did this come about? So why Hardstyle Juice? Obvious from anyone who knows the business a bit, you can tell from the title what it's about. But Clay, I know you're a wrestling guy. Maybe Ricardo, you are as well. Where did this story come from?
Well, it came from the fact that Ricardo and I are both wrestling guys, and we've been friends for a while, and you know we text all the time talking about, right, we've been to a number of different shows together, and I had been wanting to do a wrestling comic for a long time, but I had never really quite figured out what the story was going to be. And then a few years ago Ricardo did this sketchbook he put out, and he did this drawing of this female deathmatch wrestler for the cover of it, and as soon as I saw the cover, the whole story just like exploded into my head. It doesn't happen very often, but I'm not exaggerating when I say I saw that and I like was texting him immediately being like, what is this? Is this from something? I have an idea. I think it's going to be this. Are you interested? Do you want to do it? And then, you know, he let me calm down a minute and then he said, yeah, sure. That sounds cool.
Yeah, calm down.
Is it true that you two are actually secretly a tag team wrestling duo that goes through the underground circuits?
Sure. Yes. We usually wear masks.
Be a secret if we confirm it.
Yeah.
There you go.
We usually wear masks though, so you can't tell which one is which.
What's your wrestling name?
Confirm it.
What did you say, Rick?
I can't confirm. It's a secret.
That's true.
All right.
Confirm it.
All right.
That's a great lightning round question, Gramps.
Dang, I wasted it. Premature lightning round.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so, yeah, you guys both go back a long way with wrestling, then, I'm sure. So,
yeah,
were any of the aspects of the story, does any of that come from real life inspirations in the business or anything? Any real life figures? Because, like, this, the story centers on this family that runs a a struggling wrestling promotion, and you know, God knows there are a lot of those around.
Well, I you know, there's not a ton of wrestling comics out there. There's more in the recent years, but the ones that were out there tended to be based on real wrestlers, you know, WWE comics, stuff like that. And the ones that weren't tended to take wrestling and really go over the top opera with it, which is great. You know, that's, it's kind of built into the look of everything. But I had been, I think Ricardo and I both had been pretty inspired by the more last 10 years or so of the indie scene, where it was a little bit more down and dirty, a little bit more relatable. I actually, as I started getting into it, I saw a lot of similarities between what they do and what in the comic book world, as far as, you know, going to different towns. Every wrestling show is kind of like a little convention, sort of, because they all put their stuff out to sell merch in between matches. And, you know, the drawings that we do is are just as impressive as anything they do in the ring, I think. So how do you feel about it, Rick?
Yeah, I agree with that.
But yeah, we wanted to kind of to keep it more down to earth, and kind of walk the line between reality and hyper reality. So we picked a wrestling family that's multi-generational, but there's this deathmatch, high style, high violence aspect to it to really take advantage of the comic book medium and hopefully make something that is pretty exciting that walks in both worlds a bit.
I think
I think you guys have caught the perfect time. Like Clay, when you and I met for the first time at Boston Fan Expo, I remember we hung out that night and you had inklings of working on your main project, but I knew one of your main passion projects, you kept telling me, hey, we're coming out with the wrestling comic, and it's finally come, and I was able to read what you shared with us, and I was blown away. I think just knowing who you are, and I know following you on Instagram, you've done a lot of research with the indie scene, and now it's all coming full circle and making a lot of sense to me why you've been doing this research, because you really captured what you do best, but you captured this kind of the dark side of what it is to be part of a wrestling family. Right. I think to me, you know, my wife too, like she watches these documentaries and I feel like the wrestling scene has taken over, you know, these documentaries. I call them darkumentaries because at the end of the day, like they end in only one way. Right.
A lot of them do, yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. Right? Whether it's a family tradition or where it's a generational thing, it never ends good. And that's why I call it a darkumentary. And you've seen these major releases like Iron Claw and, you know, even just coming off of WrestleMania weekend, you know, the Bray Wyatt documentary.
Sure.
Unfortunately, it happens to good people. And I think you've really captured, you know, this journey of this girl who wants to honor her brother, but you know, it's geared toward tragedy. And that's, you know, the idea of deathmatch, and to me just encapsulates what you're trying to say in these stories.
Thanks. Thanks. I should have you speak at my wedding. That's very nice. Thank you.
I will.
You know, it's one of the big influences. And also thank you for pointing out all the research I've been doing, quote unquote, by going to wrestling.
It's so hard.
As often as possible.
I feel like
it's grueling.
But honestly, it is
wrestling shows as like tax deductions.
Oh yeah, it's great. Yeah.
So, and the next project you guys are doing is a comic book about the adult film industry. So you'll be doing some research there.
Yeah, this whole series is just a big tax shelter.
There you go.
As it should be.
Yeah. But yeah, one of the big influences actually was there's a series that ran on Vice before the Dark Side of the Ring series that was just called The Wrestlers. That was every episode was a look at a different kind of lesser known aspect of wrestling around the world. So they had an episode that was all about Japanese Joshi wrestlers, an episode all about the American independent scene, which was really great. If you watch that now, like 90% of the guys in it are in either AEW or WWE, which is really cool. Yeah. There's this amazing episode where they go and follow Bolivian, I think they're called Cholitas, which are, it's an all female wrestling promotion where all of the wrestlers, the majority of them are women, and they all dress in traditional Bolivian clothing. It's really fascinating. It's like in this really tiny area of Bolivia where these women have kind of used this professional wrestling as a way to work through a lot of personal trauma that they've dealt with. And that kind of stuff, seeing how people find their way through the darkness that you're talking about through wrestling is what really kind of interested me too. Cause I wanted it. I think Rick and I both wanted this to be a story that wasn't just doom and gloom. Cause that is what it is all the time in these stories. Right. And I think that's kind of the road that our main character, Chris Castro, goes on, is using wrestling as an outlet for revenge, for grief, for all sorts of things to help her kind of work through this dark period of her life.
Sure.
It's cool too to see like the approach that you guys are taking with the book, which is like you mentioned, it's not really like, it's not only about like the wrestling. It's not only about like the pageantry of that. It's the people behind it. And something that's been like really apparent with, it feels like wrestling is its own huge industry now, with how there's like, because of the way the internet has changed, there's so much opportunity now for like the veil to be lifted and for there to be like every wrestler has like all these classic wrestlers have their own podcasts and they're telling their own stories and they're sharing like amazing behind the scenes like stories of things that happened that we never knew about as fans. As you guys being fans, like, is that exciting to kind of dive into? Have you guys been nerding out on some of that stuff? And you know, like, is that something that you guys explore?
Yeah, definitely. Like, especially like during the pandemic, because I had like nothing else to do. I was just like,
like the rest of us,
railing like a freaking wrestling podcast, like left and right, and like just listening to all the kind of stories that like wrestlers had or like people from the past and stuff. Just like listening, actually, like, one of the main things that happened is towards the end of the book, like, I got it from a podcast that I was listening to where like this guy was talking about like things getting hidden in like turnbuckles to like mess with like wrestlers and stuff, and because somebody was mad at somebody else. And so that's like, and as soon as I heard it, I was, because we were trying to figure out that main part of the book, and I was like, how about this? I listened to this guy and he talked about this story, and Clay was like, damn, that's good.
Yeah. That was a tough thing at the end, getting to the end of the first issue where we're like, all right, we know we need this guy to die, but we don't exactly know how to do it. And that bit from Ricardo was like perfect. Exactly what we needed.
Yeah. It's also like a, what the fuck? Like, you know, like when it happens, you're kind of like, wait, what? And then it's like, you hear what it was. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's pretty gross because you can actually see the, like, the incision and all that stuff. I mean, Rick, your art really, I don't know, it's very expressive, I'll say that. So I like that scene. Thanks. A lot.
Fantastic, yeah, blood splatter.
And, yeah. One thing I think is really cool, because, I mean, if you guys are like me, as a kid growing up, when I watched wrestling, you know, I would watch Saturday morning cartoons and see all these superheroes. And I kind of saw wrestlers as superheroes in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, they were like live action superheroes. And now you're crossing them over in comics, which I think is really good. Really cool.
Thanks. Yeah. It's funny because Ricardo has a bit more street cred, I think, than I do. Because he's always pulling out these Japanese things. Oh, we should do it like this guy and these people from like the old Japanese stuff. And I'm like, yeah, man, I love the Ultimate Warrior. I'm giving myself a little too little credit here, but like my introduction to professional wrestling was the Ultimate Warrior, because he was, yeah, the closest thing that there was to a live action superhero.
Right.
Oh yeah.
What's and like, you know, what you guys are talking about, the behind the scenes stuff, and I never knew it. Like, growing up as a kid, you just see what you see, right? I never knew like how difficult it was, like how experienced he was, how he was trying to end the match as quickly as possible because he was always so like burned out because he just sprints to the ring
and then shaking the ropes and
it's like it's amazing to get these little behind the scenes tidbits. It's as like never having known this stuff before, it's like a whole new world is being uncovered to you, you know?
It blew my mind when it came out that Vince McMahon was the owner of the company. I was like, the announcer? I thought Jack Tunney ran everything.
Yeah.
Rick, when did you mean the guy that's afraid of all the wrestlers owns the place?
Yeah.
Rick, when did you get into the Japanese stuff?
It was like after I saw some of it, like when WCW like started bringing in a lot of like the Japanese people over. Mm. I kind of like would like look them up online and stuff, but it was really hard to find.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like this when I first got into it, but then I kind of fell off of wrestling, and then when I got back into it, and I kind of started watching WWE again. And I was kind of like, I'm not really into what they're doing. And I was like, I remember I used to like wrestling from Japan and stuff. You see if like they're still doing stuff over there. And I was like, found like New Japan. And that was like when Kenny Omega was kind of coming up in New Japan. So kind of getting to see all that stuff was kind of wild to see his rise through New Japan and going. Then because of that, I started like looking up like old like Joshi matches and being like, holy shit, these women back in like the 80s and 90s were doing stuff that like is super relevant now. It's like people are like imitating them, and they were doing this stuff like 30 years ago or something, and it's like wild to see.
Yeah, it used to be so hard to find that stuff. Like, you would see clips of guys like Jushin Liger and stuff, but there wasn't, like, a regular weekly place to watch any of that.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah.
And, no. I was just going to say, that was one of the reasons why I was so excited that Ricardo wanted to do this with me, because his art style is very Japanese-influenced and brings a completely different kind of energy to this. That's very different than what I would have brought to it if I drew it. And so we kind of get this really nice mix of the American kind of style indie story, but with this really cool, big Japanese influenced art. And I think it makes for a really, really fun mixture.
I was about to say the exact same thing, Rick. It seems like it's almost like you're building this as a wrestling manga story.
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of like what I like wanted, like when we first started like working this out, because I was like, oh, we want this to be like, you know, action heavy and stuff like that. But I also like kind of wanted the more, you know, American storytelling style, like for like the story specifically. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like, you know, where Clay comes in and like, you know, lays all that stuff out, and then I can just kind of go crazy with the rest.
a lot of my pages do just kind of say three panels of people fighting, do whatever you want, and he just knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
People fight, go crazy.
I wanted to ask you guys before, obviously, you know, I've seen this Japanese aesthetic, and you speak about the wrestling family, but what made you guys pick a Hispanic family versus like an American family? Like, was it something that you found within yourself or your upbringing? Or because I feel like the fusion, it's very organic to me. But to me, I was kind of wondering, like, what at that one point, what made you pick the lineage? Like, was it a certain inspiration? Or
my thought behind it was, for whatever reason, the multi-generational wrestling family, just the first thing I thought of was a Hispanic or Latino family. Well, and you know, because there's so much history built into the Lucha Libre aspect of wrestling and all that kind of stuff. And I thought the mix of how the Lucha masks have a lot of significance in that culture. And in our story, the Lucha mask has a lot of significance. And also that the Lucha mask has bled into Japan. And they have their own, you know, big thing built around it. So stylistically, I thought it kind of worked nicely together.
Yeah, for the most part,
really complements the colors. So.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, for the most part, that's a big thing in like Mexico, especially. It's like in Puerto Rico a lot too, where like wrestlers like they just pass down like from father to son, like the gimmick, like the same exact. So it would be like, you know, it'll be like
Blue Devil or Blue Demon, yeah.
Like that. Yeah, and it's like it was the original Blue Demon, and it's like La Parca gets passed down to like his son, and
Rey Mysterio, like, right?
Yeah, Rey Mysterio.
Yeah.
Right. Even though like he's there, they're not doing like the exact same because they're like now like more like, you know, Dominic is in WWE and stuff.
Right.
And past that, but like, you know, same with like Andrade. He comes from like a huge like wrestling family, like the Guerreros, you know. And so that's kind of like where that whole thing came from.
Now, you mentioned the colors. Had you worked with the colorist Heather Moore previously?
I had never worked with her before, but she's like a really good friend of mine. And she's colored like a bunch of like people who I think their work is amazing. And she's done an incredible job. So I just really wanted to work with her. So when I pitched it to her and she was like, hell yeah, I'll do it, I was like really happy.
Yeah, because she knocked it out of the park, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was blown away when she sent us the final sequence of the first issue, because we didn't really give her any guidelines. And, you know, we're kind of jumping around. We got a couple timelines going, kind of leading up to the big climax. And I wasn't really sure. I knew we had to separate it somehow, but I didn't give her any guidelines. And what she ended up doing, I thought, was so inventive and incredible looking.
Yeah, I mean, she really gives it, you know, a three-dimensional depth, especially with some of the lighting effects that she uses. I love that. And I also, I'm a big fan whenever comic artists or colorists use that old-school style Zippitone.
Well, that's you. That's mostly you, Rick, right?
I put it in your black
and white. Okay. Well, kudos to you, bro. I love that stuff, man. I love that. It reminds me so much of like reading newspaper strip comics and the older.
Mazzucchelli, like Daredevils and stuff
that. Yeah, I love it. Anytime anybody puts one of those, that style of art in there and shading and rendering, I love it.
Well, to bring it back to the manga thing, I love the colors, but every time when we first got the letters in, which DC Hopkins did our letters for us, and they specifically tried to do a manga style lettering scheme. Mm-hmm. And once I saw that on top of Rick's black and white art, I was like, man, I would love to put this out in black and white because it just feels like it would be a great manga book. Mm-hmm. It just had the perfect look, but you know, I love the colors. I love the black and white. I love it all.
The back to what you mentioned, Gramps, about the lighting. There's moments like in the issues when, you know, you're looking through the scenes and it really does look like there's like lens flares and it's just like, you know, it looks like what it would look like if someone was taking a photo or was like filming this, you know, and this is like, that's the image you're getting on the Jumbotron or the Titantron, you know. And it was cool. It's cool to get those little details and know it's like, oh, that's awesome, you know.
Good job, Heather.
Yeah, she's amazing. Like,
yeah, she's excellent.
Yeah, she's so damn good. It's crazy.
Seems like she might be slumming it a bit working with us, but
yeah,
we're happy to have her.
We should be.
I'm not supposed to talk about that.
Yeah. Like, insane amount of work. She's the best.
How does it come together then? So like you guys are you're already like texting or talking about wrestling as fans. You get the idea and the opportunity then to like finally come up with the story. So like, where does the pitch, how do you come up with the pitch? Who do you go to? It's obviously coming out Comixology, but like, how did that come about? Who did you go to? Like, cause it's not an easy thing to do, you know, to go from the idea to actually getting it made.
Well, you know, it's funny because when we kind of started kicking it around, the most important thing to me was I felt like this was something people were going to really enjoy, but we needed to get it into their hands. And I didn't want it to just be another book on the shelf somewhere. And so we had actually briefly thought about doing it as a Kickstarter. But Ricardo had a friend who was working at Comixology, who was the head of Comixology Originals at the time. And did you introduce it to him? I can't remember what the timeline of it was.
Yeah. I like, they were like at the time looking for pitches and stuff. And so I sent them the pitch document that we had made and stuff. And apparently they loved it and gave us the green light. So I was like,
that's
all right,
awesome. Sick.
Yeah, we had the pitch packet, I think, for a couple years, maybe about a year. I think we had that kind of kicking around.
Yeah.
We were kind of looking for the right place to take it and the right time to do it.
Yeah, we weren't sure, like, what to, because we were, like, debating it being a Kickstarter or, like, if we should, like, go to Image or, like, try, like, maybe, like, through Dark Horse or stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then this thing came up, and I was like, this feels right, so...
I think nowadays that seems to be such a really great opportunity to, as a beta test, to kind of introduce a new audience. And then I know, you know, Clay, we've seen things like Sean, where a lot of artists have kind of worked in reverse, right? It's fans have the appetite to really have it in physical media, but sure. You have this big pulse where people start reading in on Comixology, and not only do they want to celebrate it digitally, but they do want to have it home to collect. So I think I easily see that as an opportunity for you guys to start having it in single issues and then maybe expanding in hardcover and, you know, conceptual things like that. So I think what you guys are doing is spot on to, you know, how you should be doing it for fans.
Thanks, man. Yeah, the plan as of right now is through Comixology, it comes out digitally first, issue by issue. And then they'll put out a digital trade. And then I don't know what the timeline is. I don't know if it's like 6 months or maybe a little bit longer. But then Dark Horse should be putting out the trade in hard copy, which will be
awesome.
Nice.
Awesome.
And will you be attending, indie wrestling matches in costume promoting this?
That's well, a good I'll idea. Tell you. One of
I
the
assume
things-
they haven't already.
When we were starting to talk about this and the ball was getting rolling, I think Rick and I were both like, what are the chances we can like sponsor a wrestling event or have like a book launch with a wrestling promotion or something like that? So, you know, it's always been in the pie in the sky things to somehow actually sponsor an event of some kind.
Well, that's a good idea because I'm in Dallas. There's a local radio show that once a year they have a grudge match type of boxing event that they put on, and you apply for it. You know, you say, I want to fight my boss or I want to fight my ex-wife or something like that. And they pick like three bouts. And I mean, thousands of people attend this thing.
Jesus.
And I mean, they put on these oversized gloves. It's not like, super,
oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not putting on like 12 ounce gloves and going in there. But I mean, these people go off on each other. So I think we should do this.
Death match. Real life death match.
We were joking. Rick is good friends with Daniel Warren Johnson, who did Do a Powerbomb, another great wrestling book. And we were joking, like, should we turn heel on Daniel and just start a feud?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Crossover.
Should we tell him about it or should we just surprise him about being assholes to him?
Like write other wrestlers into your book or something? And
I think you
anytime
should get
we do one of these,
Mel to do it.
Anytime we do one of these, we just start cutting promos on other wrestling books.
Yeah. You do a crossover event storyline where it's like Invasion.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, man, that's another thing. I don't know if you guys were watching at the time, but when WWE bought WCW,
of course,
that was insane. Like, watching
how it transpired live on air.
That was like insane. To see that happening live, you know, and
I just finished reading a book. I think it was called The Death of WCW, which was all about that whole fiasco.
Oh, wow.
And I realized about halfway through it, I was like, I've read one like 300 page book. I've watched multiple documentaries. I think for a certain for people of a certain generation, this is like our Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
like any new documentary or book, it's like, well, I need to know what they got out of Sting this time that he's never said before. So I need to read the whole thing.
Yeah, because I was a big WCW kid. So when like that happened, I was like, I'm done.
You like WCW?
Yeah, I was like, versus oh my WWE. God, I can't see Sting anywhere because he didn't go to WWF at the time, and I was just like, what the, like,
that was
thing anymore, or like, yeah,
that was such a real thing. Like, what happens to all these like headlining A-list wrestlers that didn't come over? And then you'd see guys come over like Lance Storm, I don't know, like dudes that would come over. You're like, okay, they brought them over just to be jobbers, it seems to humiliate these guys.
All of them like really bad, so it's like, because the thing was that like a lot of the big name people, they have like crazy guaranteed contracts that like pay them a lot of money. So if they went to the WWE, they would have to like get a new contract that's probably not going to be as good. So a lot of them just rode those contracts out.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some of them went to Japan, right? Like, didn't Sting go to Japan for a little bit? And
yeah.
You know, I was going to say earlier too, like when you think of the idea of Japan, a lot of these wrestlers, they see a point in their career where they have to reinvent themselves, and they automatically go to Japan to get that hunger again and to learn and to kind of start from scratch and get that inspiration that got them going from the beginning. And it's almost their second coming, right? You've seen AJ Styles, you've seen
Mercedes, Cody
Cody's the perfect example of why you go to Japan to kind of to relearn and appreciate why you even started the business, right? So
even Hogan did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really weird to think of.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
In reverse, right?
You go.
No, you can jump in, but like these guys are at top, and then they feel the need that they have to go there again to get the street cred as well, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say it's really weird to think of Hulk Hogan in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Yeah. But he went over there. I think when he got fired by Vince Sr., he went over to Japan for a few years and then came back and started the Hulkamania thing. So, yeah, it's definitely a reset.
Almost joined Metallica, apparently.
Sure.
According to him.
Yeah. But, you know,
I was almost in Metallica, brother.
Talking about that era, that WCW era, I had been just a wrestling fan up through the Stone Cold Steve Austin stuff. And I kind of fell off, you know, right around the time that all kind of collapsed over at WCW. And one of the things that kept me thinking about it, and I think is one of the things that had always put this in the back of my head as a story, was the Bret Hart documentary, the Wrestling with Shadows.
Yeah.
Where you got to see the behind the scenes aspect of the Montreal Screwjob.
Dude.
And it was the first time where I really saw that, like, there's a really blurry line in this business between real life and worked life, if you will. And that really fascinated me. And the more I kind of heard about some of these more extreme stories, like Scott Hall or Hawk from the Road Warriors, where they have these demons in real life that they are now becoming superstars by playing people with these same demons, like that's going to be a total, you know, mess with you like crazy. And unfortunately both of them are no longer with us, but like that blurring of the line, I think is what really has always interested me in doing a comic book story.
Mm. I mean, you're describing these guys going through a lapse of reality, right?
Like,
there's no separation. And whether it's coming from a heritage or it's their escapism, or they just have to keep going until they stop, or they can't stop. Right? You see guys like Ric Flair; he's not stopping.
Oh yeah,
he's coded, right?
He's a real King Castro.
That's all he knows. He cannot stop; otherwise, he could just crash. You know? Yeah.
The first thing that I had thought of when I came up with the site, like the first scene that stuck out to me, was it's something that happens in the third issue. So I don't think you guys have seen it yet, where it was this idea where our main character, Chris, is in a death match with someone and the entire crowd is cheering on the violence, but what they don't realize is they're watching an interrogation. Mm-hmm. So she's rough beating the shit out of this guy, trying to get information about what happened to her brother. And what's happening in the ring is real, but everybody outside just thinks it's part of the show. And once that popped into my head, I was like, okay, yeah, I think this will be something we can get some story out of.
Yeah, it's great.
That's what's cool about the book is like there's a continuous thread of that in the first two issues you see where there is action, there is wrestling, but there is this like conspiracy. There's a conspiracy happening behind the scenes, like within this family, that there's an answer that has to come out that's getting forced out, and that's as interesting as the action and the violence.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's the one thing I was really hoping is because I know. Rick's art is and Heather's colors are gonna, nothing but net from anywhere in the court. But making the mystery and kind of conspiracy aspect interesting was what I was really concerned with pulling off. And I'm glad to hear that you enjoy it.
So I just want to touch back on something. So it sounds like when the digital version runs its course, it's going straight to a hardcover collected edition where we're not going to see like single issues.
I don't think so. As far as I know, I don't know if it's going to be hardcover, but it will. What we've been told is it'll go to Dark Horse as a trade. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Cool. I'm just asking for my own knowledge here. I work in a comic shop here and like, we're not a big city, but it's one, it's a big comic city, and two, it's a really big pro wrestling town.
Excellent.
Like we have, there's a promoter like Scott DeMore is from here, who just ran TNA for like a decade or something. Oh, yep. Mm-hmm. And he operated BCW here forever, and that was a big, all the big names here, and it's just a huge wrestling town, so I know I can put a lot of copies of this in people's hands at the shop.
Awesome. You guys hosted Mick Foley for a signing, right?
We had a signing with Mick Foley. That was a crazy day.
And then you got to have dinner with him after.
That was the icing on the cake with that. He did a signing and photo ops and all that for what, maybe 5-6 hours, and then after the shop closed we all went out for dinner, and by that time we were getting into the night, so the restaurant we went to had closed. It's a friend of ours is the head chef there, so we met up with him there after it was closed and just had this private dinner with Mick, and that was crazy.
Was that a real Chris Farley show situation where you were just like, do you remember when
largely
Undertaker? Well,
the funny thing though, because so we had just spent that 5-6 hours of, so we had the signing, the shop is two floors. So it's Rogues Gallery Comics in Windsor. So we're two floors. So we did the signing in the upstairs, with this line that wound around the upstairs, down the stairs, through the main floor, outside and down the street. So you've got all these hours of everyone coming up to have their moment with Mick, get their picture taken, pick up a shirt or whatever from him, and he would give everyone an anecdote and everyone got to ask their questions. So you spend the whole day, like I was like on photo duty, so when people came up and they wanted their selfies with them, I would take their phone if they had a phone with them and take the picture for them, or use my phone, and we later uploaded them for everyone to get theirs. So that was my job, taking the pictures, handing Mick his belt for the photo. So after spending all those hours hearing everyone asking those same questions, everyone did. Do you remember when you and Undertaker did that? So after you spend the whole day hearing him answer those questions 300 times, by the end of it, by the time we were at dinner, Mick was, he wanted to talk about like horror movies and the Mandela effect. And he got a phone call from Chris Cyborg while we were sitting there. And so, you got to see this whole other side of him. But I definitely got my fill of the Chris Farley show questions. Do you remember this? But it's, even those are interesting to hear because like when he talks, everyone asks about the Hell in the Cell match.
Of course.
And to hear him talk about that, like frankly, how, if you ask him, he'll tell you he still feels the injuries from that. He can still feel where he hit the floor coming off that cell. Yeah. That's just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, talk about like the Kennedy assassination of like our youths, right? Like,
yeah.
Do you guys remember when you first saw that match? Like what did it do to your brains? As because my first thing is, well, I guess later as an adult is like, who signed on? Like he could have died. He could have died multiple times during that match. Who signed off on this? Like, it's just insane. Do you guys remember like how old you were, where you were, what you thought?
Yeah, I remember watching it.
98,
97? Something like that. Yeah,
that sounds right. Most of that stuff happened in like
Jamie. Can you bring that up, please?
Now, I had spent enough time watching like not only ECW but like XPW and you know Japanese death matches and stuff. So the biggest surprise was just that it happened there. You know that. Call them the major leagues, you know, that they did something that big was that was the surprise.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Rick, when did you first see that? Because I don't know if I didn't see it at the time. The one for me at that time, that was the big one, was Undertaker Shawn Michaels, where Michaels goes off the top through the desk. And for me at the time as a kid, I was like, that's the craziest shit I've ever seen. Until Kane showed up at the end of the match, that was the craziest shit I'd ever seen. Yeah. But yeah, Rick, do you remember seeing that match for the first time?
I think I saw that later because it was a pay-per-view. So
it was like, June 28th. Yeah. It was King of the Ring.
Yeah, so like I 98, saw like highlights. Maybe I saw it like online, like clips or something. But I definitely saw the full match like later. I remember when I was like 16 or something. 17 yeah. And like I watched it, I was like, God damn, that's crazy.
Yeah. But I rented it. It was King of the Ring 98, rented it from Blockbuster Video on Huntington Drive in San Marino, California. And I think it was also that wasn't even the main event, I don't think.
No,
I think, yeah, that wasn't even the main event. I think the main event was Kane Stone Cold. Yeah. I think.
Yeah.
That wasn't even the main event.
It's funny, you were talking about something in issue 3 that actually reminded me of that Taker and Foley match, because you know, you're talking about there's that interrogation happening in the ring and the audience is cheering on the violence and they don't understand what they're actually seeing. And I remember thinking that during that cell match, because you've got, you know, Mick has gone off the top of the cell and then climbed back up and then went through it, and you know all that beating he's taking, and I remember the audience was chanting Undertaker, and I remember, what the fuck are you guys chanting? Chant for the guy that's taken this damage,
in most insane bump ever.
911 911
by God. Yeah. They killed him.
Yeah, I love the chants are so awesome. Sometimes was holy shit, or you this is up. Awesome. Clap, 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 clap. This is awesome. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, I think I've revealed that I'm significantly older than you guys by revealing that I was watching that stuff live. I used to, so we're right across the border from Detroit. So when I was a kid, if you had an antenna, like even any antenna, you could pick up Detroit channels, and so that was what I grew up watching, mostly Detroit, you know, TV channel. Like our news channels were Detroit news, and watching like Jeffersons and stuff like that. And each week, I would, my bedroom in the basement, I would disconnect the cable and hook up my antenna, so I could pick up the right Detroit channel to watch ECW.
Excellent.
So I think we found out where you need to do your first promo wrestling match. Probably in Windsor, Canada.
There you go.
Hey, let's do it.
Yeah, right.
And have Mick Foley. Detroit and...
Well, you know.
There you go. Yeah, I'll text him.
You know, the thing also that I think we both wanted to do with this is, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia for the old era of wrestling, whether it's the 90s WWE stuff or the territory stuff that comes before it, because there's just a lot of mythology built into that, right? You know, you can watch these guys sit around a table and talk for 5 hours telling these insane stories about people bringing guns to shows and throwing bricks at them and stuff.
Yeah.
But what I think we both wanted to do was set it in the modern indie era, because it is so great what they're doing out there. And these people are working so hard. Yeah. And they're so good.
Yeah. It is. Go ahead.
You guys captured the feel of indie shows in these pages, you know, because not everyone has been to, you know, local indie shows, but it isn't the same as the stuff you see on TV. You know, it's not this
right.
giant arena with, you know, 50-foot TV screens and stuff like that. You know, you get these shows in small buildings with, you know, the front row is, you know, 5 feet from yeah. the ringside, and there's a few hundred people crammed in elbow to elbow. And you guys really made it feel like that.
I went to a show a couple weeks ago that was in a brewery where it was like the furthest away from the ring was probably like 25 feet, you know? So they put wrestling rings wherever they can find them. And sometimes they don't even use them. Rick, you've been to the bar stuff, right? Where they don't.
Yeah.
You just fight in the bar.
Oh God.
No ring death matches here in Brooklyn.
That's crazy.
And it rules. They just do it at a bar or something. And people getting like poured beer on their faces and stuff. And they'll like go out on the street and fight on the street and stuff.
Oh,
and
man.
It's like a no DQ.
Stuff. Yeah, it's really good stuff.
That's fantastic.
Back in the 90s, Scott D'Amore's promotion here in Windsor used to do each summer, they would do one event that was outdoors, and the ring was set up like right beside the Detroit River. And so you're cool. Right beside the river watching this live show.
That's pretty cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when I was writing the script, obviously the dynamic is I write something and then Rick just makes it better. And so when I originally wrote it, I'm like, okay, so they probably work in this like dingy VFW. And then he came back with the first pencils that was like a little bit more elaborate than that. And I was like, yeah, that's just cooler looking. Let's go with that one. So it's the same idea, but, you know, more interesting to look at than like a VFW that's crumbling from the inside.
I was going to say before too, like the beauty about, you know, the hope that people see as fans there. And this in the independent scene is these guys are like one step away from potentially making it.
Well, they all have that dream, right? Yeah.
Right. And it does happen. And you captured that. Like when Ray died, this other guy was a Thunder. He became an international, he became a movie star. He became like larger than life because of her brother, you know, Chris's brother dying. And that happens in real life too. Like, it's the next man up, right? Like, you never know what happens where someone gets a shot. You know, I was talking to one of my coworkers. When my daughter was little, we went to a baseball game and halftime was an indie show and Rey Mysterio was there. And it was the middle of nowhere where I grew up, right? And 2 years later, this guy does a whole run of WrestleManias. So it's like the peaks and valleys of your career. But he may have just taken some time off to kind of reestablish himself and learn and have that passion again, right? But you never know that a renowned legend would do this small little show, like, you know?
That is what's wild is, you know, these guys who are on TV every week, they're still out there doing these smaller indie shows all the time, you know?
Right.
The AEW guys have a little bit more freedom to do that than the WWE guys. But, you know, it's funny. We, this character of Ray Castro, who's the older brother in the family. I think Rick and I realized we both kind of made him too interesting because, like he's the design is fantastic. And, you know, by the end of the issue, I know Rick was saying, it's like, yeah, is there any way we could like do more with him? And I'm like, yeah, he's pretty cool. I wish we didn't have to.
Yeah. I was like, can we do like 5 issues of just him? And then like, then everything happens.
Anyone watching the YouTube version here, just this page that I've got up, this is sort of like the culmination of Show and Ray's popularity. And I love that you got the streamers in there too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
That's a big thing.
Yeah. Anyway. And we needed him to be this kind of character who looks like he's one step away from greatness, you know?
Yeah.
And
he's the ultimate baby face, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Really, and in real life, he's kind of an asshole. So.
I like how also, and I'm kind of skipping ahead to book two, but
sure,
you know, part of wrestling isn't just the acts of, you know, the combat and the wrestling. It's also the shit talking in between, you know, to sure. each other. So I like how you, you build that into, Miss Mona here when she faces off, against Mr. Gianni Thunders.
Yeah.
Who is your favorite shit talker when it comes to like a wrestling, you know, persona?
Rick, you want to take that one?
Well, right now it's probably Eddie Kingston. It's probably like one. It's like either Eddie Kingston, Jay White is also really good.
They make it like an art form, you know?
Yeah.
I had never seen Kingston until they rebooted that reboot of NWA Power they did a few handful of years ago where they were going for like the 80s aesthetic, which was super cool. And that was the first time I had ever seen Eddie Kingston and Eli Drake, who is now LA Knight. And both of those guys, when they started talking, I was like, oh, these guys, they shouldn't be here. These are two of the best talkers I've ever seen. What are they doing on NWA? No offense to NWA, but I've always been a Piper guy. I always thought Roddy Piper was just, you know, he had no limits. For better or worse, like he knew, he understood the assignment, as the kids say.
Right.
And he was going to make you hate him and say or do whatever he had to do to make you hate him, to the point where a lot of the times the guys that he was fighting thought he was, you know, being serious.
Did you guys have those thumb wrestlers as kids?
No, yeah, I had, you know what I had? I had the rubber ones that don't move, that are all like stuck in the poses. Yeah. Those are cool. Yeah.
My brothers and I had those thumb wrestlers that you stuck your thumb up the back and then you could fight and stuff like that. And I always got stuck with Roddy Piper and I just hated that guy.
He's not visually the most flashy, but you know,
he's the
ultimate, Rick, what would you say the word? I want to say he's like the ultimate worker who did exactly what he needed to do to get the other guy over, you know, sometime to his own detriment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He was just like, he was so good at like, kind of like Bret Hart kind of like had that problem too. Like he's so good at like making others, like look good that they were often used as like, all right, well, you're going to eat the pin because we need this person to like, you need to prop this guy up and stuff.
Yeah.
And
that's another thing that I found very fascinating as I've gotten deeper and deeper into it, is this, it's kind of its own little world, right? With its own politics and it's even its own language, you know, different words, which we try to convey as much as we can without it coming off as insulting. You know, I don't want to make it, we don't want it to seem like we're just a bunch of idiots doing this. We want it to feel real and have the language feel lived in and not just be like, you know, kayfabe, Mark, blah, 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 you know, just buzzwords. But yeah, there's all sorts of internal politics that are like weird Game of Thrones type shit, you know, where you've got guys who are arguably the best wrestlers in the company, who are the ones who only end up being stepping stones for the next person that the company wants to make the big name, you know, like your Roddy Piper's or even like Mr. Perfect or somebody like that, who's just an A-plus wrestler, but he's almost too good to be a champion, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's definitely like a choreography, and, you know, watching WrestleMania for 2 days straight, you see that you got to trust the other guy, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Without that level of trust and choreography, it just doesn't come out proper and someone can get hurt. But without that synchronization, it's a shit show. And I think you've seen in the past guys who have really started hurting other people, whether you're Goldberg or Warrior, who just did not, you know, Nia Jax fucking crushing everyone's face. But But yeah, certain guys, Seth Rollins gets it. I think Macho Man always kind of got it, right? He took pride in taking a loss because he put on a show, right?
Oh yeah.
So it's really an off one. Like we had said before, acting, it's everything. It's storytelling. Like Graham said, it's legitimately real life superheroes, but and they're also selling that sense of hope, right? That's why these guys are plugged in. I say guys because it's mostly guys, but it's the same dopamine levels that we get from watching a Batman movie or reading a comic book.
Right? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. For it's sure. At when you boil it down, it's most of the time it's good versus evil. And that's
live
about
theater,
as, yeah, basic as it gets. And like, that's why anytime, you know, I try to, instead of fight the, isn't that just fake thing? I try to fight it with being like, watch it, like actually give it a chance and try to appreciate all of the stuff that's going on, because it's like, it's an athletic showcase. It's improv theater. It's a stunt show. It's a battle. And also anybody's like, isn't this fake? I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, there's no, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are fake too. You know, it's,
yeah, right.
Yeah, Batman isn't real.
Yeah,
I love how you handle that in the beginning of issue two, where the girls are talking around Mona at the lunch table, and then she gets the pop can and, you know, gives herself a little cut, and then she's wearing that sweater. Where can we get one of those sweater?
Was that the STFU sweater? Is that
you can find that anywhere.
You should. Yeah. That should be your official merch.
Yeah, have you guys ever seen the Bill Maher clip from his show when he had?
Oh hell yeah!
I can't remember who it all was, but I remember Roddy Piper.
Piper, yeah.
What is it real though? Is it real though? New rule, no more. And it's like, you know, he's being such a douchebag.
You know, that's one of those things. Again, very fascinating, because like, it's a little, the line has kind of gone away at that point to a certain extent, right? It's not. At that point, there is an understanding that this is not a legitimate contest. But you go back 10 years and you've got stuff like Hulk Hogan choking out Richard Belzer on national television because, like, he can't expose the business because some dickhead is like, well, it's not really real, right? It's like, you gotta show up. You gotta be Hulk Hogan and choke the guy out.
Yeah.
There's that clip from maybe the late 80s, early 90s. Geraldo Rivera is at, backstage at some wrestling show. Ooh, and I forget who it is that he's talking to. Yeah. He's Geraldo Rivera.
Was
I forget
it Sid Vicious?
Who he was talking to.
I think it was somebody else. I don't think it's Geraldo Rivera. I think
they did an episode of Dark Side.
Either way, he puts him on the floor.
Yeah.
He slaps him in the ear and it ruptures his eardrum.
Yeah.
Is that real? And then he asks him, was that fake?
I remember hearing that there was a rule basically where the guys running the promotion were like, do not get in bar fights, and if you do, you better fucking win, because if you don't, you're basically exposing everybody that you're not actually as tough as you look.
Yeah. This is why I love, there's a clip too of Brock Lesnar, I think it was versus Cain Velasquez, and the fight's over, but Undertaker went to go watch the fight. So a UFC commentator is in the crowd interviewing the Undertaker, and he's like, oh, you know, why'd you come down here? And he's like, what'd you think of the fight? And he goes, I thought Brock had it, but obviously, you know. And then Brock comes like into the crowd and walks by the Undertaker, and for a second you're like, oh, are these two guys gonna fucking get into it right now? And they're just staring each other down, no words. They just stare each other down, and Brock just walks by him like with this look at the Undertaker, and the Undertaker just like looks at him, and they walk by, and the commentator's like, what was that all about? And he's like, we got history. And it's like, and then you're like, wait a minute, like, do they really fucking hate each other, or is this like a work? Like,
always,
what is going?
Always working, man.
Always. So amazing. Or like the stories of, I think it was Jericho who was talking about it. I don't know where he was in public, but he was like in an elevator. He was full heel at the time, and so he's in an elevator somewhere with like a dad and his kid, and the kid's like 10 years old, and the kid's like nervous and like wants to like, knows who he is, knows it's Jericho, wants to like ask for a photo or an autograph, and then like the kid's going to like ask him a question, and then Jericho just looks at him and goes, "Not today." And then and Jericho talks about it. He's like, you know, you just got to keep it up. I was in full heel, and you know,
well, it's do it. I mean, MJF is the living embodiment of that now, basically. I think.
Yeah, I think he's like pretty much the only one doing it now. I don't think
Roman Reigns had that good moment. I think in the press conference after night one of WrestleMania, where asked a question and he kicked somebody out. That's pretty.
Yeah, lady. Yeah, because she boos him.
Yes,
it's funny. My daughter is almost 11, and first night she goes on her phone and she says, "Dad, is this real?" And I said, "You tell me." And so she reads a generic Google message, and it says, "Hey, it's an improv act, blah blah blah." And she goes, "Oh, so they know the outcome?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "Why don't you just watch it?" And maybe like one or two matches in, it's almost the main event, and she's literally standing in front of the TV, pointing at the finger, screaming at their screen. And I was like, for someone thinks that this is improv, you're legitimately standing and you're screaming and you're jumping out of your body because it's tapped into that emotional response that you're relating to what's happening, right? So
yeah, you're a good dad.
That was like a very interesting, well, she's gone to events ever since she was 5, but now that she's 12, she's smarter than everyone, but it was interesting to see that she got that emotional impulse and was jumping and screaming kind of like when I was little, you know, so
yeah, absolutely.
She enjoyed it too, you know, so it was kind of funny because it was kind of like she contradicted what she read, right?
Yeah. And there's so much drama built into it. Like when we were putting the book together, the thing that I kept thinking about was The Godfather. Because the way we kind of set this up is the same kind of thing where you've got this family that lives for professional wrestling and you've got the one person who's like, yeah, I like it. I appreciate it, but I have other things I'd like to do with my life. And then, you know, something just when she thought she got out, they'd pull her right back in, you know?
Yeah.
You don't understand, Karen. This is my father's legacy.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's amazing. There's a viral clip that was going around. I don't know if it was night two main event when Rhodes beats Roman Reigns, but there's like this dad is filming his son and his daughter, and the son is like maybe 10 years old, this kid, just crying, just so angry, just like you could feel the visceral hatred for what's happening like on the screen, and the dad is just like giggling, laughing, like filming that, and he goes, "That's why we do it. That's why we do it."
Yeah,
it's so real to this kid. He's got so much anger, and like he hates this wrestler.
I went to my nephew's birthday on Sunday, and I had an American Nightmare hoodie, and one of the dad leans in and it was like, "That's my son." He went to bed Saturday night, and I said goodnight to him, and he was in tears. And he said, "What happened? I have no idea." And the kid was just crying, saying, "But Dad, they cheated. They cheated." And you know, he, you know. And I told him, I was like, "Just wait till tomorrow. Let's see what happens." Yeah. Right? But it's you know, they've recaptured the reason why everyone loves it, and it's the storytelling. But to see those things, like these kids, you know, they're trying to, they see that moral compass getting broken.
Yeah.
Reality.
Yeah, their reality is melting. What they thought, like the rules, that's not the rules.
Like, you know, like that happened to me when I was younger, when Macho Man lost and I thought he was retired forever. I was crying because I was like, I'll never see him again.
Man, one of the most traumatic moments of my young life was when Shawn Michaels put Marty Jannetty through a window.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's still something I think about where I was like, oh, God, that was quite a moment.
Yeah,
but you know,
I think Clay's like that's why I'll never get a haircut again.
Yeah, I don't trust barbers.
Just growing it.
No,
I'm gonna get kicked through a window.
If any one of my friends or family says, "Let's go talk at the barber shop," I know something bad is gonna happen.
And then they're gonna become famous, and you're not.
Yeah, you're gonna start writing real weird Facebook messages.
Yeah,
but you know, I think with modern wrestling too, there is a tendency for modern wrestling fans to feel like they're smarter than the business is. And I wish less people had that mindset of, like, you know, trying to game things out and figure out what's going to, you know, the smart mark kind of mentality, because right. when they get you, it's just so, it's so great. Like, if you just let the story work and it's a great story, you know, you end up standing on your feet cheering for someone getting fake kicked in the face.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly magic. What Tom just said before, like when he saw the Lesnar Undertaker, is like, it tricked you, or it had you thinking twice, like, wait a minute, what's happening? Like, is it part of the show, or is it improv? Is it off, you know, is it off beat? Like, there's really no way of really depicting. That's the beauty, right? They're like magicians, but you honestly don't know if where's the break of reality. There is none.
Right. Yeah.
Brock Lesnar is,
they're like interweaved, you know?
Brock is literally like in just off a UFC fight that he lost, and he's working with the Undertaker in the crowd. Like, it's like, wait, what the fuck? Like, you know, this is like mind bending. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, what was, you, Rick, you said you were a WCW guy. Who was your wrestler when you were like in it? Who was your guy?
So it was Sting and, Juventud Guerrera. Those were my guys. And then, I remember, like, when Jericho went on this heel run where he was, like, unmasking all the luchadors. Man, I fucking hated him so much. He's like, he unmasked Juventud. I think he unmasked Psychosis. He unmasked, like, a bunch of them. And it was just like, what the? And I think, like, I think Rey Mysterio put the stop to it. And it was, like, awesome. And I was just like, holy crap, this is...
That's the definition of big dick energy right there, when you start unmasking those guys.
Like the cruiserweights were just incredible in WCW. Yeah. They were just doing, like, insane stuff that you were just like, God dang, this is incredible.
Yeah.
Then I kind of remember, like, the first time that, like, the first match that, like, I realized that, like, oh, I like the, where it didn't matter, like, who the character was. And I was like, oh, I noticed it, like, oh man, these guys put on a banger of a match. Like, that was crazy good. And it was two people that, like, when I was a kid, I didn't care about. And it was Kurt Hennig and DDP.
Oh, hell
yeah. And I was they just got nothing with their character. And I don't get it. I don't get why people, like, love them. And they, like, went out, had this, like, incredible match, and I remember that was the first time that, like, it clicked, where I was like, oh man, it's not just about the character.
Story, you know. It's every great match is a story in and of itself, you know, like, if they're doing their job right, they're telling you a story just by what they're doing. That's why I always thought the best wrestling move is the figure four, because it's the only wrestling move that it has a story built into it. Because someone puts you in the figure four, and now the story is, are you going to tap, or are you going to dig down and flip it and reverse it? And so now they're the one in the move. You know, it's got drama built into the move instead of a regular, just like, oh, is he going to tap or not? There's a whole story, little mini story built inside the match, story built inside the larger thing. It's, you know, it's very fun.
It's so good because, like, you know, everybody has been either put somebody, or somebody else has put you in a figure four, and you know how much that thing sucks.
It does suck. Yeah.
It hurts. It's so painful.
Yeah.
My uncle, I was just talking about this with my mom. I was telling my mom, like, Mom, do you remember when Uncle Hector used to put me in a sharpshooter? And, like, he didn't, like, do it. Like, he did it. He, like, he put me in it, and then he would stretch my back as far as he could. And I was crying and in tears, asked, like, screaming at the top of my lungs for someone to help me. And I'm like, do you remember that? She's like, I remember that. It's like,
I remember that. You cried like a bitch.
It's kind of like the rite of passage in the 90s, right? It's like an older cousin would powerbomb you, or do something to you that would just make the whole living room shake. And
Me and my friends didn't either, like, break a neck or, like, break a back. They're, like, either power bombing each other on the grass, or, like, while driving each other on the grass and stuff. And it's just like, and we were like, because we don't know how to do this shit. So we were like thinking it's real. So you're like, oh yeah, your head has to go below the thighs so that it actually hits the ground. Jeez. You know,
there was actually a time in my household. So I'm the middle child of three brothers. There was a time where my mom and dad had to force us to quit watching wrestling just to save my dad, because we would just blindside him with the moves that we saw the night before.
Happy Father's Day. Chop! <You know? laughs>
So they said, no more wrestling.
Yeah, I broke my bed suplexing my brother off the desk onto the bed. And
that was last week.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. There's I think everyone who's got siblings in the family has a story about breaking some furniture or some limb from pretending to wrestle if you grew up at a certain time.
I got really good applying the $1 million dream to my sister, which I'm sure she probably really appreciated. But
Yeah.
And even more so that you're talking about it now.
Yeah. Now it's making me money. So take that. Mom.
I made it.
Yeah.
Clay, speaking of making it, we were at one point talking about a little comic book you guys are doing.
Yeah.
So one thing that I do want to get out for the people who haven't yet seen the promotional materials and that of it, what would you tell people is the basic story of this?
Rick, how would you describe it?
It's basically a pro wrestling murder mystery. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, that's the
elevator pitch.
Yeah, I always end up going too long with them. Like, so there's a family, and then they're in wrestling, and then there's this person. Rick's just like, it's a pro wrestling murder mystery. Just that's fine.
I do declare.
And how many issues is this?
It is 5 issues right now. We don't know if we're going to do more. Awesome. We'd like to. All of the stuff that we've been talking about tonight is stuff that Rick and I have been like, oh, it'd be so great if we could, you know, we want to take Chris to Japan. We want
to, I was about to ask.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to do with it was, and I know this is not it's not reinventing the wheel here, but the idea of, I love the idea of how wrestling, independent wrestling is, you're just going town to town, basically every night almost. And it reminded me of like the Incredible Hulk TV show or something like that, David Banner rolls into town, gets into some trouble, turns into the Hulk, solves the problem, then goes on to the next town. And I thought it was a really great kind of analog for gimmick, if you will, for a story like this, where you can have this wrestler who's going into town. Maybe sometimes she's dealing with the main plot regarding her family. Maybe sometimes she isn't, you know?
Yeah, in Canada, we had a version of that same story, but it was a dog who did it. It was called The Littlest Hobo. Is this German Shepherd that would roam around.
Oh, I know that. I've never seen it, but I've heard of The Littlest Hobo, yeah.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I had always thought a lot about the X-Files. About how, you know, Mulder has the search for his sister as his core driving thing. But some episodes are about that. Some episodes are about the Jersey Devil or something. You know, it's not
Monster of the Week stuff.
Yeah, it just it really opens you up to a new world of what professional wrestling is and how it exists in different parts of the country and stuff like that.
Well, yeah. And I mean, you know, that's the great thing about the world that you're building in this story is that there's so much real life reference material to use too and pull from. I mean, the stories just write themselves.
I wish they did.
Okay.
But no, there is so much. Yeah, I know Rick is dying for us to go to Japan. And because that was one of the first things that he said. He was like, could we do what if we did a tournament in Japan? I'm like, we've got 5 issues to get this off the ground. Maybe we'll do that next time.
Yeah. No, that'd be really cool.
I mean, like you said, you can go through the progressions of her life. We know that she wants to aspire to go to school. Like, I can easily see her wrestling on a Monday night and then going to class the next day with a black eye. Like,
sure.
How fucking crazy would that be? And how realistic would that be? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a wrestler right now, Billy Starks, and she had won a belt the night before. I think it was the night before her prom. So she went to prom.
Oh my god, that's wild.
Pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like how cool is that? You know.
Yeah. So, she's only like she's like 18, 19 right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Man. But yeah, you know, like one of the stories that stood out to me was, man, I wish I could remember the guy who does these, but if you go on YouTube, there's a series, there's this guy who did a series of short form documentaries about a lot of indie wrestlers who are now, you know, big names. And he did one on a two-parter on Johnny Gargano and Candice LeRae. And Candice LeRae was talking about how she was working as in a bakery. And she would work like 12 hours in the bakery and then drive 50, 100 miles up California to make $50 in a wrestling show and then drive back so she could get back to the bakery at 4 a.m. to work the next day. And it's like that's the kind of thing that I find so relatable and endearing about these, about the people who do this, is they are doing these larger than life things, but they're all really hardworking, doing the thing they love while they're also trying to, you know, support their family and stuff.
And all those people that are now on TV doing it, they've all spent years doing it in those, you know, little rooms for, you know, maybe 20 people sometimes. And, you know, not even there not being the main event, you know, like the, even that they were the person who was in the first match of the night, you know, ahead of whatever, you know, bigger names might have been on that card. Like, I don't know if every city's you know, indie wrestling promotion was the same experience that ours was here, but like in the mid 90s we would have that, you know, it was the first five matches were local guys and girls, and then, you know, the main event was like Sabu and Tommy Dreamer.
Sure. Yeah.
And yeah, you know, but all those people are, you know, the people that are on TV now spent those years being the people who were at the beginning of those small shows.
Oh, and absolutely.
Just putting in all that work for nothing, you know, maybe even not even getting paid for that.
I remember I saw Orange Cassidy at some indie show maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I was like, what the hell is this? Mm-hmm. I loved it, but it was like, it's nice that he enjoys doing this, but I don't know if this is ever going to be a thing. And of course, he's now one of the biggest things in the industry.
Yeah. And that's also like the really cool thing about it. Like, I always tell people, like, if you like wrestling, like, don't just watch like the big promotions, like watch the indie stuff, because like nothing feels cooler than like seeing somebody show up like on one of the big promotion, and you'd be like, oh man, I saw them 7-6 years ago when they were just like, you know, starting out or whatever, you know, like I, like since I'm here in New York, like, you know, I saw like Willow Nightingale, like Statlander and Alex Reynolds and like John Silver, like Dark, because they all like are in this area, and so getting to see them, you know, starting out and like then seeing them now, like getting, you know, paid a lot more and like in these bigger spotlights. And even if it's just like somebody that's just showing up for like a one-time thing, it's always just cool to like, you know, it's like the indie scene is the lifeblood of wrestling. And people shouldn't like forget that. It's like super important.
Yeah.
Wait, and I don't know what it's like now, but I haven't watched in a long time. So I'm sure there's still at least some of it going on, but another thing that, you know, you would get from watching the smaller stuff is maybe when those people finally broke through and got to the big shows, sometimes when they would get, you know, to the WWF level, you would see that, oh, they don't know what to do with this guy. It's,
oh, definitely,
you know, what they have him doing here is, you know, back in ECW, when, you know, Raven and Tommy Dreamer were there, the stories that they told there were some of the best that there had, even to now, I'm sure, have ever been. But then they got so big that, you know, when they started showing up in WCW and WWF, they didn't know what to do with them outside of trying with Raven to just, WCW basically tried to recreate what Raven had done in ECW. But like when Tommy Dreamer was on, you know, he was royalty in ECW, and then he you know, Vince McMahon gets a hold of him and he became the guy that ate weird things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they don't know what to do with these dudes.
Yeah. Well, you know, a modern example of that, if you guys watch NXT, is Dijak, who I've known Dijak, not personally, but I've known him as a wrestler for 7 or 8 years now, because he was in the local thing in Boston, Chaotic Wrestling, all the time. And he was fantastic. He's excellent, excellent wrestler. And so when he showed up on NXT, I was really excited. And then they just kind of didn't really know what to do with him. And they put him in a mask and made him part of that stupid retribution thing or whatever it was called. And then now he's vaguely racist. I'm not really sure what's going on with him. But,
oh, man.
But he's a fantastic wrestler. And anytime you put him in a ring with Keith Lee or something, they tear the house down. But some guys, yeah, they just can't quite exactly figure out where the peg goes. And that's something I wanted to do in the book too, is like, as we, cause as they, we have, talks about in, I think it's issue two. Yeah. When this, one of our characters, Candy Rockets, who's the kind of second in command to King Castro, who runs the thing, has to sit down with Chris and says, you know, you've never even really worked a match. You've kind of just do this hardcore stuff and you don't really know what goes into this. And so I always wanted in the future to, when Chris goes out on her own, to be in a situation where she actually needs to, the thing that she does is not the thing that they need her to do. And so she needs to get broken back down again to learn how to do it right. We got a lot of plans for Chris Castro.
Very cool. Very
hopefully cool. We get to do them.
Hopefully, yes.
Well, that was quite a journey. We veered way off of the intended topic and just
once
got
you start, once you get six guys together talking about wrestling, it's like, oh, yeah. 1993. Yeah. I saw the British Bulldog in Tatanka, and it's, you know,
that was the shit. But yeah, what we were here for. Hard Style Juice, April 16th.
Mm-hmm.
So April 16th, issue one on Comixology. Any last things you guys want to tell potential readers before we let you get out of here?
Well, we did want to tell you that it's difficult with this stuff to be like, all right, well, you got to do, you got to go to Amazon and you got to go to Comixology. So just go to hardstylejuice.com and that'll take you directly to the Amazon page where you can buy the book.
Okay.
And we'll include links with all of this too.
Awesome.
Very nice.
But we appreciate you guys taking the time to do it. I know it's a busy couple weeks. You guys have got to be out doing all the press and all that. So we appreciate you making some time to be here with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, that was Ricardo Lopez Ortiz and Clayton McCormick. This was Bat Force Radio. Thanks. Love you. Bye.